Rupert Callender has spent and is still spending his time raging against the machine, citing punk culture, acid houses, and spontaneous performance art as his mainstream. So how ironic that his profession in life concerns the one thing we can't rail against, death. His book, What Remains, speaks to all of the above, including his 25 years as a green funeral director. He's written a book that I think is culturally important for our time. I'm Robin, and this is Tributaries. Rupert, my mind went straight to Shakespeare just receiving your book, What Remains, and not because you're English, but I could sense the bard, the teller of tales that reach into all of life and all of lives.
Wow. If you're comparing me to Shakespeare, that is an enormous compliment, Robin, and one that I can't possibly measure up to, but thank you very much nonetheless. I mean, I think, you know, people's stories absolutely fascinate me.
Yes.
As I suspect they fascinate you, really. I think they're the most interesting thing in the universe. So I'm always eager and hungry to hear more stories.
Yes, I certainly think your broad acceptance of life only enhances that storytelling. What is significant about starting your book with you secretly in the wee hours making a crop circle when you are writing a book about life, death, ritual, and human art of undertaking? Why did you start there?
Well, I thought it a good place to start because I was 47 when that episode happened. I'd been an undertaker for over 20 years then. You know, I had reached a point, my marriage was coming to an end, and I was quite overwhelmed by quite a lot of grief at that point. So I had turned to the art of kind of trying to ritually throw off grief by laying them down in crop circles. And I thought it was a good narrative place to start, really, especially as I was going to be talking not just about funerals and death and life, but a great deal about my own story. I thought it good to kind of root it in a moment, which was, you know, quite a difficult time for me then. I had had a run of funerals which were particularly sad, particularly of a man who is exactly the same age as me, actually, a DJ, would have been part of my tribe, and he took his own life, and I was really shocked by that. I was shocked by how much his wife loved him and how much his wife tried to stop that happening and how she couldn't stop it happening. So I did feel a certain amount of despair. So I think that I turned to kind of magic and ritual and art to try and throw it off. It was a new focus for me in trying to cope with the currents of this job, which are quite extreme. So I thought it was a good place to start.
Yes. I completely agree that any sort of art or ritual or ceremony is better than therapy. We're getting a glimpse into how you incorporate that into your life. How do you incorporate that into the way you have a funeral?
Yeah, well, I mean, the burial ground that I use the most, there's a natural burial ground called Sharpham Meadow, and I set it up. It's owned and run by a charity, but I set it up for them and ran it for the first 4 years. And when I was running that, when we first went up to look at the fields and see this beautiful hillside, which now is covered in graves, probably about 350 graves on this hillside now. But when I went there, I thought very strongly about the ritual nature of what we were going to be doing, which was turning this ordinary hillside into a graveyard and filling it with people and memories and very, very powerful emotions. So the first thing we did was we found the kind of roughly the center of the field, and we dug a circle, we dug the turf out, we made a fire pit. And when we opened the burial ground, we opened it on Midsummer's Day, June the 21st, and we opened it with a fire. And ever since then, I've done two funerals up there this week, and both of those funerals have had the fire lit, even though They've not been playing a major part in the ritual of it. It's almost for me, really. The fire is lit, and it's a kind of symbolic portal, really, for whoever is the next person who's going to be buried. And it's where we stop as we're carrying the coffin down to the grave. It's where we stop and all take a moment and put some more wood on the fire. And I suppose little things like that, which if they work for me ritually, then I know they're going to work for other people. And other people that absolutely have loved the fire. It's now called the Ancestors' Fire. Hmm. And it has something like at least 10 people's cremated remains scattered in it. The idea being that every time the fire is lit, the kind of bone fragments hidden deep in the bed of the fire glow, and that person is remembered, even if they're not consciously remembered. Something I really like doing rituals which people don't even notice, or they're not big showy things. They're just kind of little ways of marking the moment. That's how I bring that into the funerals we do.
Beautiful, because any kind of ritual really does bring a depth to whatever it is. And as you just mentioned, it doesn't even matter if it's on a conscious level.
Yeah, there's something wonderful about stopping everyday time, as it were, you know, stopping your kind of casual routine of what you do in the day to just do a really simple little ritual that just kind of freshens up the moment, I think.
Yeah, and I always look at that as almost like an electrical current. Here we are doing our daily thing, and it's flowing, and it's circular, and it's moving. But when we can take that moment just to switch gears or go inside, however you want to look at it, it breaks that current. And the more we do that, I think that vortex is created to have those moments be more present in our lives and happen even more spontaneously just by the fact that they get built on all the time.
Absolutely. And I almost think that the smaller the ritual, the better, really. The less complicated, the less cluttered. Because if you're doing it with people, if you're trying to involve people in a ritual, you can so often lose them if you make it too prescriptive or too new age or too this represents this, you know. Just to do something really, really simple. For my own personal kind of rituals, they usually either involve water or fire or a kind of combination of the both. I think the water in a clean glass held in a light-filled window is a beautiful thing to kind of revolve your life around in a very simple ritual framework. And fire as well, candles, you know, simple candles or a bigger fire outside. These are really, really powerful ways to kind of root you into the moment.
And I'm not sure if you call yourself a funeral director or undertaker, but what gaping hole were you inspired to fill by being green in the funeral business? And maybe if we learned the origin of the word undertaker, that would be a good place to start this.
I call myself both. I call myself a funeral director and an undertaker. I suppose it depends on who I'm talking to, really. Sometimes people need to have the authority of the word funeral director and all that it implies. But I call myself an undertaker generally. People always assume that the word undertaker is because you're taking someone under the soil, under the ground, you're burying them. But in fact, the word undertaker comes from you are undertaking to look after the living by dealing with the dead. It's a pledge. You are undertaking a promise. And I really, really like that commitment to other people in the word undertaker. You're going, I will undertake to do this for you, to do this difficult thing with you and for you. You know, the greenness, like a lot of my generation, you know, I was born in 1970, so I kind of grew up with a lot of the green and environmental campaigns and things like that. So greenness in everything was always kind of obvious for me. Mm. And I've been involved in various projects. I've been involved in, helped and worked on a lot of organic farms and worked with turbines, water turbines and alternative technology and things like that. So when I decided that I was going to become an undertaker, as you'll know from the book, was a kind of blinding, in the moment thing where I just saw someone on television who absolutely inspired me. And I suddenly realized that most of my life had been leading up to this moment when I realized that I could be an undertaker. But for me, it was the whole ethos of what I do and what I, and it hasn't changed in 25 years. arrived fully formed, as it were. So I knew exactly how I was going to do it. I knew what I was not going to do, which in some ways is more important than knowing what you're going to do. I knew I was not going to dress formally and have a lot of bearers and flunkies to carry the coffin and be very formal and sad. I knew that I wasn't going to do it like that. I knew that I was going to do it in a sort of disruptive way, that I was going to try and break down the hierarchy between the relationship between the funeral director and the bereaved and try to make it more egalitarian. But it was just obvious as well that greenness needed to be a real part of that. And it was obvious as well that where greenness needed to come in funerals was around the coffins, which often have a lot of plastics and a lot of chemicals and MDF and horrible things involved in the actual coffin, and also embalming, which is a very violent process and also uses some pretty, pretty dangerous chemicals. So I knew straight away I was not going to embalm and I was not going to use modern coffins with all sorts of additives to them. I was going to keep it pure and simple, and that doing that was actually quite easy, really.
Yeah. Is the big question then, in being a funeral director, how to serve the living by taking care of the dead? And what's maybe your first step in doing that, in connecting to your clients?
I think our first step in connecting to them is, it's always just to say, what happened? What has happened? And obviously what has happened is that somebody has died, but there are so many different ways to get to that.
They might be
the age of 100, died peacefully in their beds. They might be a teenager who has taken their own life. So that question, what has happened, is kind of absolutely vital, because they then get the chance to tell me the story.
Yes.
And I get my chance to react to it and kind of know what we're going to go into, really.
Mm-hmm.
And also hopefully establish our relationship. I mean, as we said at the beginning of this, I am endlessly curious about people. I don't think there is anybody who is boring. I don't think they exist.
So, Rupert, you wrote many insights in your book, but one I liked in particular, and this feeds back into what we were just talking about, is how you had moments of horror in death turn to privilege. And this type of ability, I think, to turn experiential alchemy certainly serves you. And it must have been a talent or an awareness you've had for your life, or for a lot of it anyway.
I think experiential alchemy, I like that. That's a lovely phrase. It's probably curiosity, really.
Mm.
When I first started this, you know, I hadn't ever seen a dead body until I started this work. The first dead body I've ever touched was the first funeral I did. So for me, it was an endless learning curve. And for the first few years, the dead body was a source of absolute fascination. The difference, the almost thread-like difference between the living and the dead, which is so profound, just kind of held my attention always. And then I started to see bodies that were in various states of distress. And I think we've been conditioned by horror movies and, you know, to see a lot of things as absolutely disgusting and the worst possible thing we could think of in the world. But yeah, my experience of seeing these things was a lot of it as just going, actually, this horrific thing is not as horrific as I had initially imagined. It's very sad, and it's strangely humbling to see these kind of natural forces of decay, to see what happens to a body after some time, or if a body's been in the sea for a certain amount of time, or you know, all of these things just actually made me feel very tender towards the person whose body it was. I think I'm not alone in that. I think obviously if you're not expecting to see a body in extremis, and you do, it will be a shocking thing. But I think if you're expecting it and your imagination has built up all sorts of ideas about what they're going to, when you actually do encounter them, they're not so bad. And this is one of the reasons that we encourage families to come and spend time with the person who has died. Their idea of what they're going to look like in their head is nearly always worse than what they actually do look like. And our imagination can hold an image of someone in our head for 20 or 30 years, but if you actually see them and then go, oh, okay, it is the person who I expected it to be, and that is them without life, and it's a fascinating thing. None of it is as bad as anyone would imagine.
I think you wrote in your book about shock being a place, and yes, I liked that your tagline in your The Green Funeral Company is honesty, appropriateness, and participation, and you certainly allow for that participation, and I'm sure everyone that works with you really appreciates that. That's really an amazing way to really get things grounded and maybe move through grief more easily.
It is. And, you know, the way that I facilitate that are incredibly simple. They really are. In the UK, the people who work with the funeral director, whose job it is to carry the coffin, they're saying they're called bearers. So I don't have any bearers. I just have my colleague who I work with. There's just two of us. On a practical level, that means that the coffin has to be carried with other people. My colleague and I can move the coffin around with a trolley, but it doesn't work ceremonially. So that very simple thing of going, well, we have to carry the coffin between us, means that people who might not have necessarily thought they were going to participate actually do participate. It can be quite tricky for me. It's, you know, sometimes I have funerals where there's not many people or all the mourners are quite elderly, and that, you know, it would be easier at that point to go, don't worry, I've got six guys, they're going to come in, they're going to take the coffin, they're going to do it smoothly, they're going to carry it. But actually, it's always worked out. It's always worked out. Sometimes I have to get the grave digger to give us a hand, but it's always worked out. And also at Sharpen Meadow, the graves that we use are deliberately shallow. They're about 3 foot deep, and that's because the shallower you bury somebody, the better the bacterial activity, the quicker you decay. But it also means that to lower someone into the ground is not that intimidating. And to help fill the grave in is not that intimidating either. We supply about 4 or 5 shovels for people if they want to help the grave digger. And nearly always people do want to help the grave digger. And between us, it takes probably about 1/4 hour to fill in the grave. And that really, that's as participatory as you can possibly get. You've done it in a way that your ancestors would recognize. You know, you've carried somebody's dead weight, you've put them in the ground, you fill that hole in. These are very, very primal feelings. So simple to facilitate, if a little nerve-wracking from time to time.
I'm sure there's a lot that gets nerve-wracking on occasion, maybe more so than other professions.
Oh, my God, Robin. It is the levels of stress. Because everybody's funeral is, for them, an enormous event, an enormous family event. And if something goes slightly wrong, they remember it forever. But there's a responsibility with not wanting to ruin it that goes with a funeral that is quite quite nerve-wracking, to say the least.
Yes, and I really appreciated your honesty. Now, your book is about the work that you're doing in the world, but it's also about your world and who you are. And you are pretty out there and gloriously, in my mind. It's just great how you really embrace extreme and dance and rave. You know, I don't think a lot of people would have been able to do the book the way you did in being so honest for fear of having clients slip off.
Yeah, it was a worry. I'm not going to lie, Robin. Part of me was thinking, well, someone's asked me to write a book. I might not ever have the chance again to properly make my case, as it were. And so I thought I would tell everything. I would be as honest about myself and my failings, because there's something about being a funeral director, particularly someone who takes the ceremonies, in which lives are there for the scrutiny. And, you know, very quickly you see that most people are just trying to make the best of the circumstances they've been born into and the things that have happened to them. They're not necessarily bad. They just might do bad things because bad things were done unto them. So I felt the need to try and be as honest as I possibly could. But you're absolutely right. I did worry that it might cause potential funerals for them to read the book and go, well, that's too far out. I did feel very, very exposing when it came out. I was quite alarmed, actually. And I didn't completely say everything. But I did a pretty good job of going, this is who I am, you know,
yes,
warts and all.
Yeah. Well, I also love how you've embraced ancestry and your ancestors, acknowledging that it really has nothing to do with bloodlines. It's more of a familiarity being key.
Absolutely. Obviously, there is bloodline in all of us, and we're all slightly obsessed these days with genealogy. And I come from a very posh Scottish family. I can trace my ancestors back to Robert the Bruce. And so there's all that kind of sort of, you know, heraldry in my ancestral past. You know, I do also think that people have a tendency to fetishize their own ancestors. And we tend to give the idea of our ancestors a bit too much power. We give people who came before us this kind of unwarranted wisdom. There's quite often we project onto them that they lived a simpler life. You know, they were hardworking and they were more honest. I think that progress is an ongoing thing. And I believe that we are probably the best version of our genetic stock that is possible, because we are in possession of the full facts. We know things that my grandparents didn't know, you know, sort of things like inherent racism, which happened 100 years ago, the ideas that other races weren't as sophisticated or as clever. You know, we now know that not to be true. That's just because I live in this time. But it does mean that I reset my relationship with my ancestors, and I want it to be a kind of two-way street, as it were. But as you say, I also very much feel that I know that, that my ancestors who've had more effect on the way I have lived have not been my genetic ancestors. They've not been my grandparents or my great-uncle or anyone like that. They've been cultural ancestors. You know, there are figures who have loomed large in my life, figures who've had enormous impact. You know, people like William Blake, the poet William Blake, and Malcolm X. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was quite young, and it absolutely blew my mind. And Malcolm X has been an enormous figure for me ever since. So, you know, I consider him one of my kind of social ancestors, and writers and musicians and all this. I think once you start to realize that you come from a bigger place than your genetic history, you come from the human family, and that contains all sorts of influential strands, and it really does open things up a bit. It's quite liberating to think that you're not just the sum of your genetic line, that you're a much bigger cultural event, as it were.
Yes. Whenever I start doing something like that, I just say, okay, I'm just going back to the very beginning. And whenever the first human arrived, I'm related to them. So that opens it all up, right?
Just as everyone is my ancestor.
You know, we've got to address here where you openly state death scares the shit out of you. And so what does that look like?
Oh, God. I mean, it still does. It still does 25 years on. And as I get older and it gets nearer, in theory, and I lose more friends around me, it still does. I still find it difficult to let go and trust that it's all going to be all right. I've got some ADHD, which I think kind of, it's accepted now, ramps up anxiety a little bit more than normal. And my experiences of losing my father when I was young really did, you know, it was a terrifying event, because I was then thought, well, what happens if my mum dies? That's it. You know, I'm on my own. I'm seven. So I think the fear of that never quite left me, really. And it keeps me fresh for the job. You know, I'm not in any way complacent around death. It's not just become, oh, another thing. It's still something which makes me shiver a bit, something I have a lot of respect for, but it's something I take very, very seriously. I don't appear to my clients to be like that, really.
Of
you know,
course.
I there's a strange thing when you're doing what you're meant to be doing, where you become the absolute essence of who you are. So when I'm working with funerals, I am this little flame of calmness.
Of course.
Which I am not in the rest of my life, you know. The rest of my life, I am an absolute nightmare, really. But I have this ability to step in, and I think maybe it's because death scares me so much. I have such a healthy respect for it. I treat it very gingerly every time. I do. I think it's a big thing. It is the biggest thing in our lives.
Yeah.
Presumably, we are pretty unique in knowing about our death, and that has kind of wounded us psychologically in some ways, because we do, it's such a difficult thing to wrap your head around.
Absolutely, yes. And affects how we live our life so much.
There's a brilliant American psychotherapist, actually, called Irving Yalom. Wrote some absolutely brilliant books. He wrote a book about the fear of death called Staring at the Sun. And he says that he believes that all neuroses are about a fear of death. So everything that a therapist has to encounter is basically a misplaced fear of death.
Yeah.
And I think once you kind of understand that and go, yeah, we only have one thing we're scared of, and that's dying, or the people we love dying.
You know, this is something I was going to say after we were done with the actual recording, but it might be fitting. Somewhere in your book, you wrote about fashioning a soul. And I just wanted to put my two cents in and say, I think our souls are fashioned and we just need the right clothes for the party. And I think as you write, it's love.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I like just the idea that you're not really born with a soul, but you have to fashion one through pain and love and all sorts of the big events. I do like the idea, but I also really like your idea that we have it and that we just have to find the right clothes which fit us. And of course, it sounds cheesy, but it is so straightforward. It's so obvious in so many situations in life, but really, it's about love. You know, people's lives are either affected by the amount of love or the lack of love in it. That's what I see very, very clearly when I'm taking a ceremony for somebody. If they're really loved, their life probably went okay. And if they weren't really loved, then that's an absolute disaster.
We could talk so much more about different events from your book and the directions you took, and it certainly goes a lot into your experiences with your current tribe, which you've gone through life with, the many artistic events and performance events that you've done and been part of. So I just really want to encourage anyone listening, what remains is, it's really an important book, I think, for the time, and I appreciate that you shared with us today about it.
Thank you so much. I didn't want to trivialize anything. I didn't want to trivialize the lives of the people I was talking about. I didn't want to trivialize my own experiences. I certainly didn't want to trivialize death. And it's very kind of you to say that it's a book for our time. Thank you, Robin. That's really kind.
Yeah. My mom is English, and I have such a very, very deep affinity for England and Wales, and my family actually had a castle in Scotland, but I don't remember the name of it, if I ever knew it. I'm always
maybe
so drawn.
Maybe we're related, Robin.
Well, I think we're ancestors. We're living ancestors.
We're all living ancestors, indeed, yeah.
Rupert Callender and his book, What Remains. Anything we do here can be found at tributariesradio.com. And our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.